Welcome to New Shooter Canada. Please remember that the show's content and word pronunciation is simply the opinion of the hosts and their guests.
We're all like guns, and I love being free. Because I'm armed, you can't take that from me, and you should know it.
Hello, and welcome to New Shooter Canada, episode 162. Tonight with us, we have Thomas.
Hello.
And Daniel.
Howdy.
And me, Benny. Hey everybody, how was your weeks?
Not bad.
Good. So Daniel, what did you do this recently in guns?
Recently, well, there's this really interesting bit of kit. I'm a sucker for kit, and it's Sandpiper of California, I believe, and it's got one of these triple mag setups and for rifle mags, and then in the front of it there's a pistol mag like insert. So it goes rifle mag, and then there's a separate tiny pouch for pistol mags. And I don't know, I've been eyeing that because it's about time to get a Hanukkah present, so there you go.
Nice. That looks like a pretty nice bit of kit.
Mm.
Anything else?
There's, you know what, I had, for the longest time, I really was hoping that Kel-Tec with their Sub 2000 would put out a 40 caliber version. And they did, and they had it in the United States, but, you know, to get it non-restricted in Canada, the barrel has to be, you know, X amount of length. So finally, someone brought it in, just completely under my radar, but they brought it in fully legit. And so I was really eyeing this 40 cal, and I really want to just test one out. It seems to be, you know, it's something I've really looked forward to shooting for a long time.
Oh, wow. Sounds interesting.
So did you get it?
Well, you know, whatchamacallit, try before you buy, right?
Yeah, true.
Nice. Thomas, what did you do this week in guns?
Let's see. I haven't really been feeling well all week because the medication the doctor was on has got me messed up. But I did make it out to the Silverdale Xmas party. Actually, it was an Xmas party / Delta Waterfowl fundraising event. It was a lot like the older National Wild Turkey Federation fundraisers. So there was about 5 or 6 guns on the prize table. There was all kinds of kit stuff, hunting gear, knives, stuff like that. And my winning streak at these events finally ceased. I didn't win a damn thing this year. But it was great. I still had a good time. I was sitting with Scott, Ian from Odell, and Dave from the Silverdale Club. And Ian donated, from Odell, donated they've got a new semi-auto 12-gauge out, and didn't Scott, when he's sitting beside me, he won it. So it was nice to see that at least somebody at my table won some stuff. What else? I also found a really cool Canadian knife maker. What's his name here? I gotta scroll down my show notes here. He's in Montreal. It's called Sports Artists. This guy has got, I put in the show notes, he's got a gorgeous, gorgeous Damascus blade knife, $215, handmade in Canada. So I'm going to go online and look at some of his stuff. And the thing I like about this time of year, you get mail delivery on Sunday. I got mail.
Nice.
It finally arrived. I ordered, I know I've been trashing some of the Turkish stuff, but I've been looking, actually I've been studying a lot of the Turkish companies, and the one company that I don't mind is Hatsan, because they are actually one of the only companies that make all their own products in-house. It's not sourced out from other companies. And I'm pretty impressed with this. The action was pretty smooth. I took the whole thing apart as soon as I got it, of course. It took all the preservatives off. There was no wear marks on the action bars. Nothing was hitting anywhere. All the polymer, any seams on the polymer had been taken off. Fit and finish is really, really nice. Trigger pull out of the box was 7.5 pounds. I did my usual thing and I tinkered with it just a little bit and cleaned it off. So I got the trigger weight down to 5.5 pounds. I don't want any less than that on a semi-auto shotgun, but I'm impressed with it. The metal work on the receiver, the barrel's really, really nice. It looks like a Benelli M4. It's got a collapsible stock with a cheek riser. It has an aluminum Picatinny rail with an integrated rear sight, fiber optic sights in the back, fiber optic sights in the front. Nice little gun. Of course, I can't play with it till the actual holidays are over because it's a gift. So, but it's nice. It's got a magazine cut off, extended charging handle on it. you know, it cost me $400 plus tax. So I can't complain where the Benelli is going to cost me over $2,000. So we'll see. It looks nice. I'm pleased with the workmanship. Trigger's nice. It fits nicely. So hopefully I'll be able to sneak it out of the house into the range in the next couple of days without the wife knowing, and I can do a little review for the show. But that's about all I've done is gun-wise is go to banquets and buy a gun. I haven't actually done any shooting. So I'm just as bad as you.
Yep.
What about you? What about you, Benny? What you doing guns this week?
Zilch. Nothing zilch, nada. Nothing at all. I haven't gone shooting. I haven't done any reloading. Although I did finish all my tumbling. So, Thomas, when you want to come by and pick up the media, it is ready for you. But otherwise, it's... Yeah, that's it. I haven't done anything.
Do you still want the brass for the menorah?
Yeah, please, actually.
Okay.
If you want to... Actually, if you want to bring the 338 Lapua also, I will work on that if the... Was it 338 Magnum? Isn't big enough. So, yeah, Danny, my... the 308 doesn't burn long enough. I need a bigger case. So
I'm thinking you need a 50 BMG case for the amount of fire time that you want.
I don't think 50. I think 50 would be, well, it wouldn't be too big, but there's no such thing as too big. But it I think I have a lot of time for burning there. I think something a little bit smaller would still be sufficient for enough oil. So.
Okay, well, I go into the city on the 5th, I can drop by and drop the brass off for you if you want. Actually, I'll just drop by the full cases, and you can rip them apart yourself.
Yeah, and I'll get rid of those primers, too.
Yeah, just make sure MD's not home when you do it.
Yeah, maybe I'll go to the farm this week. Who knows?
You need a vise and a hammer, something to set it off.
Yep. Okay, so guns in the news. Story 1. I'll take it. Type 81s have started to finally arrive. Orders prepaid in March 2016 have started to be filled. Don't blame the importer, blame the RCMP lab for the long delays. A very small number of them have a defect where either the barrel or the stock is very noticeably bent to one side. But so far, the new owners are posting that their guns are fine and straight. For some history and review of the 81, follow this link, which is going to be in the show notes. Also, current owners of the Type 81 CCFR link discuss their new toys. Again, link in the show notes. Thomas, you want to take story 2?
Story 2 is, well, it's that time of year again. What the Coalition for Gun Control wants the government to do. So I actually went on Crazy Wendy's site, and this is actually from the Coalition for Gun Control's website. So as a minimum, the Trudeau government must establish as quickly as possible a system for whom to track all gun sales, re-establishing and modernizing measures that were introduced in 1977 but eliminated in 2005. Number 2, they want to reverse the measures passed in C-42 and restore strict screening and routine licensing checks and verifications of all firearms purchases. Eliminate the loophole in the authorization to transport restricted weapons, such as handguns. There is no loophole. They just made it easier. Ban military assault weapons. Update the prohibited and restricted list consistent with the advice of police. Put in place necessary measures to allow Canadians to ratify important international agreements, including the OAS International Arms Convention against illicit manufacturing of and trafficking of firearms, ammunition, explosives. Also the 2001 Program of Action on illicit trafficking of small arms and the Marketing and Tracing Agreement and CEDAW. Restore detailed analysis of firearms death, injury, and crime imports, exports, sources of firearms in crime to support research and track progress. I believe that's already done anyway. Embark on a national awareness program to highlight the risk associated with firearms in suicides, homicides, unintentional injuries, extending our Quebec Firearms Violence Presentation Initiative, Save a Life, Ask the Question, Is There a Gun? Reinstate evidence-based approaches, which considers firearms in the context not just of the street crime, but domestic violence and suicides. Provide open and transparent access to data on guns and gun ownership, firearms, death, and injury. And bring back a comprehensive approach to preventing crime, domestic violence, and suicide, which recognizes the importance of the effective of gun control. And bring experts on public safety, suicide prevention, crime prevention, and prevention of violence against women back to the discussion table. So that is off their website. You guys have any opinions of any of this stuff that Wendy's saying? I know Daniel must.
I feel like more than 90% of that is misinformation or just plain ignorance. I don't know.
How many people on the Firearms Advisory Council have actually sat through a firearms certification course? Have we found one person who has yet?
Well,
have they changed that yet?
I would have thought the president of, Ducks Unlimited? I would think that he'd have his firearms license.
There you go.
Isn't there one Olympic shooter that's supposed to be on there?
Yeah, but for all we know, she just shoots air pistol, and then she doesn't need a
This pal. Is true. This is true. Well, they had people on the board, and they Tony Bernardo was on the board, and he was told that his services were no longer needed. So they've stacked the deck. You know, there's all kinds of people that think they know about firearms, but none of them want to actually take the course. You know, if somebody's going to make firearms laws, I think they should actually all have their licenses.
Yeah, it's just like, and like you said, the C-42, reverse the measures of C-42, restore strict screening. Nothing has been taken away from C-42 at all. If not, people argue that it made it more tough. And the limited loophole of authorized transport, that sounds like the gun show loophole, which doesn't exist. Yeah.
Well, the only thing C-42 did was put the ATT as a condition of licensing. So you weren't asking for a permission slip every time you wanted to get an ATT.
Don't forget that the C-42 also made mandatory that people are no longer able to challenge the certification exam. And, I mean, in my mind, that was a giant step backwards.
Yes.
I definitely agree with that one. That's what I meant by made the law more strict, that you couldn't challenge the test. You had to sit through the course.
And the other thing about C-42, it was domestic violence. If you, after C-42, if you got convicted of a domestic violence charge, it was an automatic lifetime prohibition on firearms. So I don't see anything that C-42 did that changed the way people access firearms. The only thing it changed is that we weren't at the mercy of the CFO every time we wanted to get an ATT because we need to belong to a club.
Yeah, I don't know, just going through point by point, tracking guns doesn't help because, I don't know about, these people seem to always be thinking of, you know, reacting to problems instead of preempting them. So what if you know where the gun came from? It's a crime's been committed. That's not going to help you, you know, fix anything. C-42 was only a positive. There is no loophole in authorization of transport. Ban military assault weapons. Those are already banned. And no police expert who actually is really a firearms expert would champion this. Put in place necessary measures to allow Canadians to ratify important. None of the UN stuff is going to make our lives any better or any safer. It's just going to make things more expensive for firearms owners. Data analysis of firearms death. Unless you're going to start.
Canada puts out stats all the time.
Exactly.
They just released one.
And unless you're going to start stacking those deaths against vehicular deaths and stuff like that, I really don't care how many people die from firearms unless you're comparing it to how many people die from cars or alcohol poisoning or bumping their head, for goodness sake. Yeah, more people probably die from hitting their head by tripping on the sidewalk a year than, you know, well, I don't. Maybe more people do die from firearms than tripping on sidewalks, but I'm sure the number is not small.
More people are killed by cars than firearms in this country,
for sure.
In that last couple of years ago, when they had the year of the gun in downtown Toronto, well, there was more traffic fatalities than actual shootings in the city of Toronto. And that latest StatsCan death by firearms, that includes everything. That includes nail guns. That includes air rifles. Everything. So right. If it's an industrial accident and somebody shot a coworker with a nail gun and they killed, they consider that a firearm death. So that's insane.
Yeah. We've said that already. Embark a national awareness program to highlight the risks associated with firearms and suicide, homicide, and unintentional injuries. I'm sure everyone already knows about homicide. Suicide, there is a lot in the firearms program discussing how to prevent it. and unintentional injuries, that's what the whole course is. It's not just Quebec.
Well, you know, if they all took the course, they would understand it, because there's a whole section in the course about mental health and you know, suicide and how you're feeling, and if you are having those thoughts, what to do and how to deal with it. So if they took the course, they might have a greater understanding of what we have to go through.
Exactly. Reinstate evidence-based approach to which consider firearms in the context not just of street. I'm sorry, but their entire philosophy and approach to the subject is emotional and not evidence-based whatsoever. And bringing public safety, suicide prevention, crime prevention, and there's nothing, violence against women. I'm pretty sure someone did a study on this, and men are more likely to get shot than women are. I don't know, Daniel, do you have any info on that?
On the specific statistics, I usually leave that stuff to research other people. I try to look at core concepts, and I think one of the things that comes up with statistics is the CIBC cited study recently that, I guess, how does it go? There's lies, damn lies, and statistics. And there was that study, you know, what the name of the researcher escapes me for the moment, but every time I see a study on firearms, I always try to say, let's look at the source material. And I think this is one of the greatest things that anybody can do, is just look at the source material. Because the first thing I went to was, it said, you know, a child is shot every day. And then, so the first thing you do is say, well, what do you define as a child? And lo and behold, up to 19, or was it 24? I don't know. But
I think it was 24. Well,
it was 24.
There you go. So it was children and young adults, and I believe the CBC had to issue a pseudo-retraction to that effect after the article came out that a child is shot every day. So the first thing is, well, what's a child? And I know this sounds like you got to take them point by point, but you do. Yeah. The next thing was, well, what does it mean, shot? Well, we found out, lo and behold, shot includes paintball guns and air rifles, or at the very least air rifles. I don't want to put words in anyone's mouth, but I know for sure air rifles were in there. So now we have shots that may or may not pierce the skin. They may or may not leave a welt. So anytime you get these statistics, it's so important to go to the source material. And, you know, anybody can say, this report says this, and then they build a statistic on it, and then maybe they couple a few studies together, so now you've got aggregated statistics, which are lots of fun. But the truth is, if you don't go into the core concept, right, then you don't know that they're including people who are up to age, you know, 24, 25, and calling them kids. And right. I mean, the truth is, as soon as that got pointed out, you know, that was done relatively quickly, and that's thanks to the strength of that wonderful thing we call the internet, that this stuff doesn't fly anymore. If you try to pull the wool over people's eyes, it's just the speed of response surpasses anything we've had in the past two decades. And I think that's a source of optimism for the pro firearm, you know, for pro firearm owners, really. Anyone who's interested in firearms and not seeing them arbitrarily banned. I think the fact that we're able to respond so quickly to misinformation, even if it comes from a PhD or whatnot, I think that really does give us heart.
Let's hope so. Let's hope so.
Thomas, you want to take story? My turn. Story three. Silverdale is now accepting membership applications once again. So for all you who are wondering where you're going to get, all you new gun owners out there wondering where you're going to go shooting next year, Silverdale has opened their membership again. So
that's the only one that I know about, because the new range at East Hill, it's full. Gagnon's is full. I haven't heard anything about Firearms Outlet Canada yet. I haven't spoken to Fred. But it should, I know they're still waiting for final approval, but I can guarantee you that range will book up probably in 30 days, no less. It'll be, even though it's going to be expensive, it'll book up fast. So the only options I know, you can either go out west and go to Silverdale, or out east and you can go to Trent Valley. Either way, you're looking at an hour and a half commute if you're looking for a place to shoot. So unfortunately.
Yep.
Unless you want to join Target Sports and pay an outrageous sum of money to shoot.
That too. So email all applications to gunrange4u@yahoo.ca. I'm sure Mike will put the link in the show notes. What's new in the industry?
Not a lot. I went online, and with the SHOT Show just around the corner, manufacturers are, you know, unusually quiet about what new products are coming out. The only one I saw, as I said, was except for Ruger, they've got a Super Red Hawk in 10mm. That's the only thing I've seen. And who'd want a Super Red Hawk in 10mm? If you get a Super Red Hawk, you want it in 44 Magnum or 454 Casull. But it was cool. The only other thing I seen was actually at the Silverdale Banquet that they Canuck introduced a new shotgun. This time they got a semi-auto version because everything else they have is pumps. And this thing was actually quite nice. It's a 3-inch chamber, a 28-inch barrel, chrome lined. It's got a ventilated rib with fiber optic front sight, mossy oak duck blind camo. Comes with 5 bred up mobile extended choke tubes and a fitted hard case. It was $600, so not bad there. And I found another Cerakoter. Actually, you guys will probably know him, Dave Fuller from the Silverdale Club. Yep. He used to actually work at MD Chartland for a couple of years before he started working at Silverdale. And he has a company called Sinister Paint. So I put his, Twitter? Or is it, sorry, I don't have my glasses, Instagram. I can't see. I put his Instagram account in there. I also put his Gmail account in there, and I put some pictures in there. And Dave's got some really cool stuff. It's not just straight Cerakoting. He's got all kinds of images and colors. I really like the grips. So if you want a Cerakote job done with a little twist to it, go check out some of the stuff that Dave's done. It's really, really nice. And he's been doing it for quite a few years, so it's going to be properly applied. But, besides that, the only thing else I found was that that new knife company that I talked about in the beginning. There's nothing really new happening these days. I think everybody's waiting to the SHOT Show to bring everything else at once. So hopefully,
yep,
that's it.
So this week's main topic was supposed to be discussing the NRA Back to Basics poster, but this week instead we're going to talk to Danny Bolofsky about his time in court with the CFO. So Danny, what got you originally into shooting?
I like to say that I grew up watching the most libertarian cartoon ever. It was great in the 80s, seriously. You had a talking car, right? It was the advent of live action cartoons, although I don't think they referred to it as that. So you had Knight Rider, which was great. And then you had these shows where a number of shows. Edward Woodward was in one, The Equalizer. George Peppard was in one, The A-Team. But I think there was there was Magnum P.I. with Tom Selleck, who joined, who was the voice of the NRA in some aspect. But growing up then, and you had G.I. Joe, of course, and everything, and you had this concept that people who were, first of all, firearms were never, ever used as something bad in those things. It was always one of those things where it was the absence of firearms that sort of played a role. So how to explain it in a simpler way? Basically, what would happen is people, and this was the plot of just about every 80s action series, was that somebody would get roughed up by a group of people who had illegally obtained arms, and they couldn't go to the police for whatever reason because of the plot line, and they had to go to these, you know, guys who were good but sort of outsider, flirting with the edges of the law, and they had guns. And you know what, and I, if you remember watching these shows, I don't think anybody ever got shot. It's really funny. There was an interview on Late Night with you can find it on YouTube, George Peppard and Edward Woodward were talking, and they said, did anyone get shot on your show? No. Did anyone get shot on your show? Seldom. And so, but it was this notion that, you know, you really got it. Even as a child, I could see that it didn't really matter about the firearm. What really mattered was the wielder. And, you know, you saw that, you know, it could be used for good, hopefully, and it could be used to stop bad. And I thought, oh, well, you know, that's a great moral lesson. But no one ever looked like they were having a bad time when they were shooting. So that was something that sort of got me that way. But the other thing was, no, I absolutely, absolutely was curious about it, because, and I think this is what happens with a lot of people, that when someone's told that you can't have something, you start to say, well, what is it? And why can't I have it? And, you know, just what are the limits of me not having it? And it's like one of those things where somebody says, the safest way to get people to read a book, if you want students to read a book, is to put it on the banned book list in school, because then they're definitely going to want to read it. So I think that ironically.
So nobody in your family hunted or went shooting?
So I didn't know about this until years after I got my license. But my grandfather told me that, yeah, when he was growing up in Allendale, which is just by Barrie area, that he used to go about with a Cooey 22. And I mean, I don't think you can get much more Canadian than that. But he worked, his father, so my great-grandfather, worked on the CNR, the Canadian National Railway. And they were blacksmiths there who worked on the rails and whatnot. And on repairs, but that's how they used to spend days, you know, just plinking about there. And I think it skipped a generation, but my story about my first firearm was I always liked the AR-7. It's called the Henry Explorer now, I believe. But there was a author named Desmond Bagley, and he featured it in one of his books called The Tightrope Man, and it was great. People also know it from...
I've actually read that. He did that one, and he did the... Was it The Freedom? I've read Desmond Bagley.
The Freedom Trap. Desmond Bagley's fantastic, and he actually died the month and the year that I was born, so, you know, that was kind of weird. He died in April of 83, and that's when I was born. But he made some fantastic, fantastic books. Wyatt's Hurricane is a fantastic one. But so I got myself an AR-7. People will also know it was in From Russia with Love. And I experimented with that AR-7 to the hilt, right? Like I found out that, well, yeah, you know, if the barrel's not in, it just will not shoot because the barrel forms an integral part of that chamber. But my father took one look at it and he said, no, go buy yourself a wooden metal gun. And I said, okay. And so that's how I got a Remington 512. And so those are my first two firearms. And I love them to pieces.
Do you still have the AR-7?
I have both, and I finally found a Remington 512 Model X, which actually has dovetail grooves cut into the receiver, and I love that. I scope that, and I just take that to the range whenever. You know, when you run out of the pricier ammunition, you can always break out your 22.
I have probably over a dozen 22s. They're addictable. They really are, because you can shoot all day and only cost you a few dollars.
Thomas is quite the 22 fanboy.
I love my 20. I've always thought, like, I'm the same as you. When I saw the James Bond movie, I wanted an AR-7. And I can remember back in the 70s, you could actually go into Simpson Sears and buy the AR-7, but it was just a little too much money for me back then.
And it was probably a Charter Arms version back then, which, you know,
well, that's what it was. It was
needed
a
bit
Arms
of
version.
Work, from what I recall, to get it to feed pretty smooth. It
yeah,
depends,
they weren't very good. Henry has really smoothed them out, though.
Mm-hmm. And Charter Arms has actually improved. I have a Charter Arms. It almost looks like a snub-nosed 22, except the barrel is, you know, ridiculously long for Canadian purposes, so it's still restricted. But it's a beautiful, beautiful 22, and it's accurate and everything. The revolvers are, from my experience, have been fantastic. I think it was just the design of the AR-7. There's not a lot of operating room. Even when I opened the side plate on it, the whole thing sprung out. And those were back in the days when you could take it to the wholesaler and they can, you know, fix it all up and everything. But yeah, it was fun doing the ammunition tests on it too. But
the Toronto Arms revolvers are well made, and they're an American company.
I really like them. I remember ammo testing for reliability, and, you know, CCI mini mags, the full not full metal jacket, right, but the round nose, those were the ones that gave me the best consistency. I'm sure Henry smoothed it up, but I mean, the mini mags really gave it the biggest cycling reliability.
I was actually looking at buying one recently, but my eyes have gotten so bad I can't see that stupid aperture sight anymore at the back.
Did you know that you can flip? There's actually, you can flip the aperture sight at the back. You can unscrew it and then, yes.
Flip it over? Correct. The problem is that at my age, I can't even focus on that. Like, I have a hard time even seeing the front sight, so I have to put optics on it, which defeats the purpose of having a takedown rifle if you got to put optics on it.
You know what? I'm going to give you a little read in here. I get no money from UTG for saying this, but UTG is a fantastic, fantastic company. And they make their, I think it's still patent pending, but whatever. You can get it on Amazon or whatever. But UTG, quick detach scope rings. And those things, you just throw it in the bag next to your takedown, whatever it is. And it's great. Like, just a small little lever. They're fantastic. and they're not expensive at all. But they work. They make them for dovetail grooves and for weaver grooves as well.
Oh, excellent. I'll have to have a look at it.
Oh, they're the lifesaver, definitely. And, yeah, I mean, it just brings back life into these firearms that, you know, maybe the iron sights are not well suited for somebody who, you know, their eyesight's changed since they originally got the firearm.
Yeah, don't rub it in. Don't rub it in.
everyone ages. What can I say?
So, yes, it's pointed out to me on a regular basis by one of our other co-hosts.
Danny, how is your interest in firearms received by your community, your friends?
I think to a person, everybody who I've mentioned it to has said, cool. I mean, I remember I was being interviewed once after the whole thing with the court, and a lady said, have you had problems dating because you own firearms? And I said, you know, just the opposite. it really tends to, I didn't want to say weed out, but I mean, it really does tend to focus your compatibility. And I think it's one of the things I got married a year ago. I just had my 1 year anniversary. And one of the things that I remember being told when I was dating, and it stuck with me, was that what's really going to get you through is shared values. And so in my mind, if you have a shared value, that doesn't restrict your dating pool so much as it focuses your attention. And I don't know, that's always been the way I've thought about it.
It's a valid point. I've known people that started dating people that didn't like guns. And it puts such a strain on the relationship to ask somebody to give up something that they truly love. You just got your sister shooting not too long ago too, right?
Me?
Wasn't one of your sisters you never got shooting? Is it Fran? Remember seeing on Facebook?
No, sorry. Rachel is my sister. And
okay.
Yeah. So Rachel was with, she was actually taking out the sub 2009 mil. And she looks funny shooting at it, but she's got a dead eye when it comes to shooting. She's very good at shooting.
Excellent.
And she loved one of my favorite things is pistol caliber carbines. I can say carbine, right? We're in Canada.
We're in Canada. Yeah. You can say Z and Z too.
Z, right.
Or lever.
I don't know. You know what's weird? The machine that threshes grain, right? That's a combine. No one calls it a combine, do they? I don't know. Whatever. I like Americans. They're great. But when you say you want to combine two things, right? You don't say I want to combine. Anyway, whatever. I try not to rang on different pronunciations. But pistol caliber carbines are fantastic. And I mean, you know, I just recently read, what was it? Jeff Cooper's book, To Ride, Shoot Straight, and Talk the Truth, or something to that effect. It's a great, great book. And, you know, it's one of those things where you get the collective knowledge and reflection of somebody who's devoted their life to shooting. And so all their tangential reflections are kind of interesting. And one of the things he said was that, you know, he had this hate on for 223, whatever, or 556. And but he really wanted to make some kind of service long arm that involved a lengthened version of the 44 auto mag. So he even had this tendency towards the pistol caliber carbine, if you will. And I know he was a fan of one of the, either the 6.8 or one of the 300s. He was given an AR in this, and then he said, you know, it was the greatest thing since sliced bread. So I don't know. I think Jeff Cooper has been described as a lifelong learner, and it's curious. I have my version of A Rifleman Went to War, you know, Herbert McBride's book. It has an introduction by Jeff Cooper. And Jeff says that, you know, most of his fondness for the 1911 probably came from the book A Rifleman Went to War. So, you know, everybody sort of ties into each other there.
I've been really looking at the Aero Precision 10 millimeter carbine. I would like that.
Well, I have a friend who hunts with it, and he thinks it's great. It might be a wee bit tough on the brass, but he loves it. And when he takes it to the range, he's got a Glock 10 mil companion piece. But when he's out when he's hunting, he actually hunts with 10 mil.
Yeah, my friend Chris, he's harvested deer with this.
Yeah, I've shot the Aero in 9, and that was just fun.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I remember when I was looking at the 40, one of my friends, and this is why friends are so important, they keep you honest. He just said point blank to me, he said, Dan, do you think you're part of the FBI? You want a 40 cal? And I'm like, okay, no, whatever. But it's good. Friends take the, whatever. They take the whatever out of you.
Well,
aren't
they going back to 9?
Depending
though?
On hunting with it, it'd be better than a 9.
You know what? I mean, I've always been impressed with... It's weird, right? You have to get the right firearm for the cartridge. It's one of those things where some people have made 410s that are really, really light. And unfortunately, that gives people the idea that the 410 is, you know, a heavy recoiling cartridge for a shotgun. And it really isn't. It's just... And the same thing with 20 gauge, right? Sometimes they just lighten the firearm to the point where the recoil becomes noticeable. And it's a shame because, you know, if you've got a, if you've got the right platform for the carbon, so, for the cartridge, so 40, Smith & Wesson, I really always thought was, you know, ideally suited as a pistol caliber carbon cartridge. I mean, there are some handguns that do fantastic with it. Don't get me wrong.
But, it'd be perfect in a carbine.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the stat that's usually thrown around is that it starts to approximate the 41 Magnum, which is, you know, a little bit of firearm trivia if people remember the 41 Magnum. But, yeah.
Oh, I've got reloading components for that. I have access to a revolver in 41 Magnum, so.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a straight shooter if I've ever shot anything, and I can say that any mistake made was by me. I can definitely say that it was with that revolver.
Well, I mean, I think where the 40 starts to shine in the pistol caliber carbons are silhouettes. So, and again, a lot depends on shot placement and everything, etc. But I know I've just friends in the U.S. who have shot a competition, and they'll say that, you know, sometimes it'll take more than one hit with a 9mm, and with the 40, it'll just knock it down. And again, this is if you're running it with a pistol caliber carbon. Sorry, that's neither here nor there. That's just random stuff.
It's all
I'm sorry,
useful.
I was supposed to talk about something with the CFO, wasn't I? Right?
We're getting there.
We're getting there.
How many times have you taken the CFO to court? Because I know, if I understand, it's been more than once.
Twice than I know of.
I think it's all been one long chain, and really it started with Silverdale. Oh, no, I'm not going to get Silverdale in trouble. No, what happened was it started with something I heard by somebody who also frequented Silverdale. There you go. That is the correct technical and truthful. Yeah, well, I was actually taking the handgun familiarization course there, and... two guys were walking out and they said, you know, it really stinks that we can't transport handguns for the purpose of teaching people because it's not one of the listed purposes. And I thought, well, you know, that's why I stayed away. I got my license in 07. I know this because that's when I became when I got my professional designation. And so that January, I got the designation in December, and then that January, or I qualified for the designation in December, I got my PAL, and I started taking that in January 2007. And where was I going with that? Where I was going with that was that that's very important that you're able to challenge the PAL, by the way. I cannot even begin to say how important that was because... I'm Jewish, and the course in Toronto was basically PAL, the long gun, the non-restricted firearms. You could take the course on Saturdays, and then the RPAL, which is, you know, certain long guns and shorter barrel lengths and handguns and whatnot, you would take on Sundays. And I would always call up and say, you know, I just can't do the Saturday. And you can't take your RPAL without your PAL. So I'm sure what I'm saying is old hat to everybody who's listening. But it really helped me that because I was able to challenge it, there was a lovely old German gentleman named Werner from the Toronto Sportsman's Group, I believe, and just by Mill Street. And he sat there and I challenged the PAL. And because I was able to challenge the PAL, 3 years later, I was able to take the RPAL I actually took the ARPAL because David Miller was about to leave office, and I thought as a final, you know, goodbye gesture, he was going to do something horrible to all of Toronto's handgun owners. So I said, I'm going to get grandfathered in. I rushed and then I took my ARPAL. But as part of taking the ARPAL, after I took the ARPAL, I took the familiarization course at Silverdale. And that's where I heard these people saying, you know, it really stinks that we can't transport firearms, you know, safely for the purpose of instructing people. And that's really when I started thinking, okay, now let me take a look into what this whole ATT business is. And so, you know, long story short, I applied for, and I got my ATT. And it was very weird because if you don't renew your club membership at that time, right, they would rescind your ATT X amount of months after, you know, failing to renew your club membership. So I thought, okay, great. As soon as they rescind it, I'm going to contest the rescinding. Stop me if I go off the rails here. But I said, I'm going to contest the rescinding. And lo and behold, I never got a rescinding letter. And I said, well, and I love how people, you know, I like to say there's the lofty legalism and then there's the gritty reality. And people will say, well, that, you know, you have constructive rescinding, right? Constructive is a big concept in law. Basically, they say, well, it's as though they rescinded it, and you can contest the constructed rescinding. But that's not what happens in the courthouse, because in the courthouse, they don't really know about firearms to begin with. And when you start trying to explain to a court clerk, you know, bless them, you know, they do the best they can. But when you try to explain a constructive rescinding of an ATT, you know, they don't want to get involved. So I actually asked for an actual rescinding letter. And they said, no, we're not giving you one. And I said, well, am I rescinded or not? And they said, well, you know, you didn't renew. And I said, yes, but am I rescinded or not? And so that went back and forth for, I'm going to say at least a month. And it's one of those things that I knew people who had said the same thing. The CFO wouldn't actually issue you either a refusal letter or a rescinding letter. And I said, this is ridiculous, because under the Firearms Act, this is from memory, but I believe that they actually have to issue you a rescinding letter. So I said, well, I want it. And so I never got my rescinding letter, but I applied to get an ATT again as a person who wasn't a member of a club. And again, they didn't really issue me a refusal letter for an ATT. So
Give you the ATT.
They didn't give it to me and they didn't refuse. So there were, and again, you know, you have people who will sit and there and say, well, they have constructive refusal. And constructive refusal is, I guess, pseudo refusal or however you want to say it. It's a legal notion, I guess. But again, a court clerk in Old City Hall is not going to understand what constructive, or even if they do understand, they're not going to get involved. And this is just my personal experience. No one, I tried to raise the issue of constructive refusal. No one wanted to touch it. And they said, where's your refusal letter? And so, I mean, they can sort of keep you in limbo unless you just keep at it. And so that was really the background to everything, was trying to get that refusal. Because once you get the refusal, you can contest it.
Now, this was all when Mr. Chris Wyatt was the CFO.
Yeah, I'm thinking this was back in 2011. Yeah,
sometime. Yeah, so it would have been Wyatt.
There's that number again. I'm sorry, I have this theory with
that
2011.
That year keeps coming up, don't you?
Yeah, Canadians and guns in 2011. It just keeps popping up there. Sorry, continue, Daniel.
Oh, no worries. Tell me if I'm rambling. I really hope I'm not. It was a long week at work. But what happened was, so then I finally got it, and then I went to the Ontario Court of Justice in Old City Hall in Toronto, and I will fully admit how naive I was, right? Like, this is – when somebody says ignorance of the law is no excuse, that doesn't necessarily mean that the law is available to the layman. So first I thought, well, you know, I was going to file – I can even remember what it was. It was Form 14F. It was a restraining order, and I was going to file a restraining order to prevent the CFO from taking away my ATT. And then I found out that it's okay. The club sort of sends information to the CFO, and they rescind it without sending you a letter in the background. And it doesn't matter because Form 14F was actually for family court, so that wouldn't have mattered anyway. And, you know, you have to be able to laugh at yourself. It's very important.
That's how we learn.
No, no family court restraining order, right? And so then I went to court because under Section 74, if I recall correctly, maybe 75, 74, I believe, is the one where someone will fact check me somewhere. And 74 says, if you're refused, you have the right to challenge it in court. So I did. And not only did I do it, but you guys know Solomon Friedman, right?
Yes.
Yep. If I mention the name. Okay. So he just came out with an edition of the Annotated Firearms Act. And what happened was, I believe that's the third edition because there were two previous editions. Let me just see if I can remember what the fellow's names were. One, the co-authors are, I believe it's Jonathan something. I don't know. And Pamela Good. So Pamela Good was actually representing the CFO, or she was involved in representing the CFO. I'm not quite sure. I can't recall at the moment the extent to what she was involved in. But one of the people who was involved in writing the Annotated Firearms Act was opposing me. And then there was just little me on the other side. And we went to court, and so we had to book a court date. And I sat down on a bench, you know, waiting for basically scheduling court. And there was a guy who was, you know, I guess a white-haired gentleman who was larger than me. And I said, how do you do? What's your name, sir? And he says, he's Christopher Wyatt. And I said, well, I'm Daniel Bolofsky. And he said, oh. And then we walked into court, and they basically said, when can we go to, I guess, the hearing? And I was outflanked because, again, I was incredibly new. And they said, well, let's book it out a year from now. So, okay. And he said, okay. And so then that's how it moved to 2012 from 2011, I believe, or it moved from 2010 to 2011. You know what? I really should have my numbers in front of me when I did this. But it moved 1 year out. It was funny
because they really flanked you on that one.
Oh, yeah. And look, I mean, I'm not going to say that I was a virtuoso or anything, like a wunderkind back then. I was learning as I was doing. But I reviewed the case law. I reviewed a lot of things. I got in touch with everybody who had been defeated in trying to get an ATT outside of having club membership. So I went through all the precedents. And that's a great story, a whole set of stories there. I'll just tell you a very quick one. There was one called McBain, which is a great name if you watch The Simpsons. But anyway, there was a person in McBain who did challenge to get an ATT without being a member. And I found this thing. I called up the courthouse records, right? And they said, oh, we don't have this file anymore. And I said, can you check? He said, oh, there's only 3 pages. And then I said, and this is where a bunch of people, I don't know if I'm allowed to use names here, so I'll just say certain CGN moderators or whatever were very, very helpful, and certain other CGN members. And they actually went down to the, I believe it was St. Thomas Courthouse, and instead of a file that didn't exist, and instead of a file that was only 3 pages long, there was a thick, thick file, including appeals and everything. And so people took copies, and lo and behold, you know, there were even sticky marks saying, let's hope this never, I'm going to paraphrase here, but let's hope this never sees the light of day. So I thought, oh, that's a great file. That
and that was a CFO sticky mark, correct?
You know what? I don't know who wrote it, and I did not see the sticky mark in person. It was described to me. So, you know, disclaimer, disclaimer. But that was the gist as it was relayed to me. So from a non-existent file to a 3-page file to a very thick file. And I mean, that came up a little bit later, but basically what happened was I went through court and I was in touch with different people. One of the people who tried to obtain the ATT without being a club member was involved in making firearm holsters. So they wanted to be able to transport handguns more freely. One of the other things was that there was another person who was a ex-Canadian Forces warrant officer. I'm just being very sparing with the names here because I'm not sure how much I'm allowed to say. But, you know, different people who had tried this before. And I went through the cases and I noticed two things. One thing was that, let me speed this up a wee bit here. So one thing I noticed was that nobody had submitted a paper argument, right? They had all tried oral arguments and they didn't have this paper argument called the factum. So I said, well, I better write a factum. And I had to learn how to do that. And the second thing I learned was that the CFO's lawyers always veered this way and that way when it came time to do the denial. So I basically looked through each reason why they denied the ATT to people who weren't members of clubs, and I made sure that I, you know, filled all those boxes. And at one point in the court, it was an Ontario Court of Justice proceeding, and they were reading through the actual case precedent from this fellow who was a Canadian Forces warrant officer, and they were reading, I think, paragraphs 9 to 14 and 16, if I'm recalling this correctly. And they're saying, and this is why, you know, previously it's been upheld not to allow a person who's not a member of a range, why they shouldn't get an ATT. And I said, well, excuse me, Your Honor, what happened to paragraph 15 of that? And I'll never forget, the judge leaned over and said, yeah, what did happen to paragraph 15 there? You went 9 to 14 and then 16. I mean, it's around that number range. And that's when things started to shift, I think, my way, just because people started to fidget there. And it was, you know, but it's the power of paper, I believe, I guess. But anyway, long story short, at some point, this was the same judge who did the – there was a shopkeeper who had effected a citizen's arrest, David Chen, I believe. And so the judge who sat on the David Chen case was also sitting on this one. But he proposed a solution, you know, like King Solomon split the baby. He said, well, maybe you guys can figure this out outside of court. I didn't want to. I wanted to get an actual conclusion. So long story short, after all the proceedings, what happened was the judge issued a court order saying, you know, and there's only three options that can result from challenging this in court. Either the decision's confirmed or it's like the CFO's decision is confirmed or it's rejected, or there's a third option. But he clicked that, you know, the CFO must issue a ATT. And the CFO didn't issue an ATT, and they made argument that, well, you know, the judge really said issue the ATT if you can come to an agreement. And then I said, no, that's not what the court order says. The court order is pretty basic. It says issue the ATT. So I think that's where that ended, right? That was the Court of Justice proceeding. And then what happened next, and, you know, to make a long story short, what happened next was I went to what's called a pre-enquête, which is basically a justice of the peace overhears if you can privately press charges. And my private charges were to say, well, you know, the CFO is not obeying a court order, right? This is disrespecting the court or whatever the proper term was. And the justice of the peace wasn't buying it. So then I appealed the justice of the peace's not buying it to the superior court. The superior court wrote a decision that to this day, I think, missed the point. So I appealed it to the Ontario Court of Appeal, and the Ontario Court of Appeal basically said, well, you know what the judge really meant. And I thought, no, that's not how the law works. None of you guys are actually, you know what, I'm perfectly okay if people play by the law, but they weren't playing by the law. They were playing by, well, you know what they meant. And, you know, that's not really how the law in theory works. But again, people will say, well, the law is supposed to work X way. And you say, well, yeah, but in the nitty gritty reality, it doesn't. One of the very important things. Sorry, I should let you guys jump in here.
No, keep going.
So what happened? Very informative. Did you ever get an ATT?
Well, what happened was C-42.
Seriously?
No, I love it. There was one person on CGN who was calling me an anarchist or something, which was great. I don't know if he meant that as a compliment or as a derogatory pejorative. But anyway, what happened was, so there's this court case called Dom, which basically says that you can't, if you want to appeal a decision, you have to appeal the decision directly. You can't be evasive and do a collateral attack. So what happened was, after I got that court order in the Ontario Court of Justice, if they didn't like it, they could have appealed it, you know, to Superior Court, but they didn't. They sort of let that chain of proceedings die. And then the new chain of proceedings started where I said, well, I'm pressing charges for not abiding by the court order. And they said, oh, well, we meant to abide by the court order, whatever, whatever, whatever. But they never actually, you see, they were trying to fight the court order in a separate set of proceedings, and you can't do that. That's what collateral attack is, and the legal system doesn't really allow that. Stop me if I'm sort of drifting off here. But basically, they lost their chance to go to superior court, right? The time elapsed, and they just didn't. So instead, I had to take them to, you know, the Justice of the Peace, who represents the Ontario Court of Justice at some level, and then that got appealed to superior court. That got appealed to Court of Appeal. And the whole time, I kept saying, you know, it's collateral attack if you keep trying to explain what the original court order meant. And I don't know, apparently the law doesn't, well, the law works in mysterious ways when it works. But but I think two big takeaways happened from all this. One was, I know people will always say that, you know, why are you trying to, throw the system into disrepute or to slag the system? Why not try to work through it? Well, you can take it to the bank that I most definitely tried to work through the system, and oh boy, did it get hairy. And all the wonderful things that people will talk about law with, constructive removal of the constructive revocation or constructive denial, none of that came into play. None of it. And collateral attack did not come into play. And I don't even think collateral attack was mentioned at all in the Court of Appeals written thing. But one of the great things was the note to the Court of Appeals ruling said, well, Section 19.1 doesn't contain any provision for what Bolofsky tried to do or whatever, something like that. And which is great, because after C-42 passed, 19.2 of the Firearms Act did contain something of what I was looking at. So what happened was, throughout the process, I was trying to say to different politicians, you know, look what's going on here. This is pretty ridiculous. They're just not obeying a court order. And some politicians were great, even though I wasn't a constituent. They wrote scathing letters. Other politicians said, well, you can't fight the RCMP or the OPP, because the OPP runs the CFO. Basically, it's a secondment in Ontario, the Ontario Provincial Police. But what happened was, one of the responses I was getting from a lot of federal politicians were, we can't comment on proceedings that are currently going through court. And, you know, I'm not the swiftest guy, but eventually I got the hint that, I don't even know if it was a hint. Eventually, I figured out that if I tried to appeal to Supreme Court, there was an election coming up, and who knows who would have gotten in after that. So I sort of said, okay, I'm not going to Supreme Court. I'm done after Court of Appeal. And then lo and behold, C-42 came out and had a provision actually enabling a lot of the things I was arguing for with the ATT. And so you tried the court, but, you know, if the law doesn't work, then you have to get new law. And that's exactly what happened with C-42.
So if that part of C-42 is removed, then you're going to have to do this all over again?
I have no idea what's going to happen if that gets removed. I really find it distasteful that people call it a loophole. It's part of the Firearms Act. I think it's an ignorant comment to call it a loophole. It's actually a provision of legislation, and it's a hard-fought provision of legislation. And I mean, who knows? If they revoke it, it might be a footnote that from 2015 to some of 2018, for 3 years, you know, some guy went ahead and tried to get the ATT expanded. It worked nationally because it's federal legislation. I was quite happy with that aspect. You know, the irony is, the only reason I got my RPAL was because I was able to challenge the PAL, and C-42 comes along and removes the ability to challenge the PAL. So there's a fair bit of irony there. But whatever.
I always wonder what the rationale was behind that. Like, why remove the option of challenging it?
Income?
Personally, I think it was some kind of notion that they were trying to say, well, we're loosening some things, we're tightening other things. And the truth is, you can't be even-handed about arbitrary law, right? So it's really an arbitrary thing to block people challenging the test, right? Either the test is good enough to screen you out, or it's not. And if you say, well, you have to sit through, I don't know, I haven't sat through the RPAL course since I took it, right? Once you're certified, you don't have to resit it. But we watched it on VHS. And for those who don't know, that's a cassette recorder. Way before CD and DVD and
MP3. But after Beta.
Yes, yes, after the Betamax folks. But what happened was, yeah, I don't understand how watching a VHS program for 4 hours or 2 hours makes you a better person or a more competent person. Either the test screens you or it doesn't. And I mean, this is really one of those things that goes to the heart of the matter, right? Either you believe that your gun control provisions work or you don't. And if deep down you believe that no amount of gun control will work, then there's nothing to stop you from arbitrarily layering on additional gun control measures. I don't understand why there's magazine capacity limits. I think that if the licensing is strong enough to screen people out, it's strong enough. And if it isn't, it isn't. But it's one of those things where, again, you're trying to be even-handed with arbitrary measures, and that never works. That's the equivalent of trying to pick up a piece of filth by the clean end. It doesn't work.
Yeah, that's a valid point.
So I don't know if that rambling was worth anything, but that's pretty much the background. And, you know, I came away after that with a little bit of understanding about things that I hadn't before. One thing was, you know, people will say, well, you got to try to work through the system. And I said, well, you have no idea what the system is, do you? I don't know, but am I allowed a little bit of a freelance comment here?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, for sure.
That's okay. So I just have some very, very quick things here. And really, I think one of the greatest things that we have now going for us as, I'm not going to say pro firearms or anti firearms or anything, as people who care about private property that are firearms, one of the greatest things we have is the strength of the internet. You can literally connect with just about anybody. If somebody, and you know, always try to be polite, always be legal, but on Twitter, you can call out people who write bad things or untrue things. And there was recently a CBC article, a webpage where I think the gun control side was getting hammered in comments on a ratio. And this is, you know, just off the top of my head, but I think 2-1 or 3-1 even. And when something is said that doesn't seem true or doesn't seem accurate or seems like fear-mongering, the internet has enabled people to respond with such swiftness and with such connectivity. So people can actually mount a national response to even a local newspaper's misinformation. One of my favorite ones was, I believe, Peel Region police. What happens when a crime's reported is that the police will issue a report, and then who's ever working the crime beat on a newspaper will basically lift and summarize off the crime report issued by the police. I know because when I used to be a university reporter, we would basically lift and report the campus security crime beat news. So I did it. I know what they do. Look, it's no great mystery. These guys all worked on their university papers. But the Peel police said they found a scoped 50 caliber sniper rifle. And in the picture was a muzzle loading bolt action with a scope on it.
Yeah.
And not only did that happen, but, oh man, the calling out of Peel Regional Police on that was amazing. I just sat back and watched, and they had to change the article. They had to change the police report. They had to apologize on Twitter, and they were called to task. And in a way that, you know, I mean, the internet is fantastic. It really is where, you know, the divide and conquer strategy, which I think really goes to a lot of gun control measures, I think it falls apart in the age of the internet. And I think that's truly fantastic that, you know, clear information is able to get out and clear organization and association is able to get out. So that's pretty fantastic.
We've seen that a few times. There was a couple of years ago, the Sportsman Show decided that they were going to have restricted firearms, and then they changed their mind. And the media just stomped on them so quickly, and they did a 360 retraction, and now we have restricted firearms at the Sportsman Show. Mind you, limited amount, but we do have them now. That's because of the instant information getting out there and people having the ability to respond in massive numbers instantly. So it is to our benefit.
I mean, and you can connect with people all over the world. And because you can connect with people all over the world, and people are very friendly, you know what? I mean, if you give them half a chance, I really do believe in the innate goodness of people. Maybe not if you're at their mercy, but if you're dealing at an equal playing field, people are very friendly. And like you can find out that in the UK, they have an ability to have sound moderators or suppressors. And it's amazing. Like, you get people who, like, Piers Morgan and, you know, anybody who says UK-style gun control, and they'll say, we need more UK-style gun control, and they never mention suppressors. And in Canada, suppressors are a prohibited device. And, I mean, as people say, you travel the world to get the benefit of, like, international experience. Well, you communicate around the world to get the benefit of international experience, and you realize Canada is incredibly backwards when it comes to suppressors. And I think that's by design. Like, I really do.
Well, even in the UK, like, most semi-automatic firearms are limited to 5 rounds, or shotguns, I should say. But you can get an FAC, and you can get an extension and make your magazine capacity 7 rounds. On your hunting shotguns in the UK, well, if you get an FAC. Mm-hmm. We're here, we're limited to 5 rounds. That's it. No more.
Well, not only that, I mean, you get that interesting situation where you can have a 30-round magazine in .223 in the UK, I believe, you know, if your firearm is, let's say, is not a semi-automatic. So there have been jobs where they basically convert the AR to a manual action, and then you can just go to town with that magazine. The laws may have changed since I last, you know, reviewed that. I don't keep up to date on my UK stuff, but I know for sure that suppressors are something that's, you know, allowed. And I mean, I've got two different ideas what's going on with suppressors in Canada. One is that there are people who do not want to give an inch on gun control because ideologically they feel that they have to own gun control and they can't give up an inch. Like, no compromise is really the attitude of gun control groups. The other aspect is that I think that, you know, I try not to attribute malice or anything, but I think that people, gun control groups, are afraid that there will be far less noise complaints if people have suppressors, and there will be a proliferation of firing ranges if there are suppressors. Because one of the biggest things that stops firing ranges and contracts the supply of firing ranges is noise complaints. So if you have suppressors, then you're going to have more ranges. And I think, you know, while I don't want to impute malicious intent, I do believe that they can see, like, you know, anybody can see that if you have suppressors, you're going to have far less noise complaints and far more firing ranges and far more people coming into the sport. So if your goal is to ideologically constrict and restrict the supply of places to shoot, then you don't want to have sound suppressors. It's a very linear, you know, cause-effect kind of mentality.
You know, and so, that's a very valid point, and I never even thought of that one.
Oh, it just, I mean, the other side of it is, and again, I don't want to impute malicious intent, but you got to think that they really don't care about the health of firearm owners because, you know, hearing, and I believe this is one of the main arguments in the European Union, is that audio health, right, is a major concern, and that's why they have suppressors. Whereas here in Canada, I guess they just don't much care about our health because they don't want us to have suppressors, which can help protect, you know, against hearing loss. And believe me, you know, I double up on ear protection. You know, I've got the soft plugs and then the hard shells. But the suppressor makes a difference. It does. And I guess you really have to have a lack of care for your fellow human being not to care about their audio health. And so when people say that, you know, people who own firearms are heartless, well, I would say the other way, that people who don't care about firearm owners' hearing, there's a bit of heartlessness there.
So, when the government's response to the petition to legalize sound moderators for firearms boiled down to, it's been illegal since was it in the 80s, I believe? I don't remember when they prohibited suppressors, but it's been illegal since then, and so it's going to stay illegal, irrelevant of the fact that the reason it was made illegal was because someone flipped over Guns and Ammo, pointed at suppressor, said, oh, that looks cool, let's ban it. That's not really the way we should be making laws anywhere, not necessarily in Canada.
One of their arguments was that if you suppress it, then people aren't going to hear gunshots and report crime, which is kind of a ridiculous.
There's more than one way to skin a cat. If you want to use a soda bottle, use a soda bottle. It'll work the same way.
Well, I mean, the other thing is what you, Thomas, what you were saying in the beginning was that there's really an attitude to going ahead and saying that we just don't trust you. And the other thing you had said, sorry, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but the exact thing that you had said that I wanted to reference was that, you know, the police are there to clean up after the crime. We want to find a registry so we can track things after the crime. Maybe this was Ben who said this. Sorry, I don't want to put words in anyone's mouth there. But, you know, it's this whole after-the-fact thing, right? After something evil happens, we'll be able to, you know, check things up. And it's a weird mentality. But the other side of it is that, again, it's definitely not a proactive mentality.
No. No. And even then, it does very little to actually fix the problem. So what, you found the last legal gun owner? It doesn't help. Particularly when I think the latest stat was 66% of guns that they find are actually brought over from the border. And there's
the RCMP shadow file, right?
Yeah, and there's
that,
a big...
That finally got FOI'd.
There's a big empty gap there where there's still firearms that they can't trace, and only about 33% of firearms they can actually trace back to Canadian gun owners. So, like, yes, any number is too big, but it's not as big as I think it is.
Well, I mean, you've got a real problem there, right? One of the issues is that if they're illegally obtained, they're illegally obtained, which means if they're stolen from a licensed owner, then that's an illegal obtaining. And if they're smuggled in, that's an illegal obtaining. So, you know, what flavor of illegal obtaining do you like, I think seems to be the question. And I like strawberry. No, I don't know. But but the other thing with the suppressors was it's a very weird argument. And you could tell this is the same thing. It goes back to, and you know, you see it all the time, right? Firearms are mechanical item, right? And it's technology. And for some reason, they hate 1896 technology because we know the Mauser C96, right? It was the semi-automatic. And so many people to this day in 2017 just don't like semi-automatic firearms. And, you know, technology has moved by leaps and bounds, but they're really stuck in a rut. And so they say the same thing with suppressors. Well, it's always been illegal. Well, we don't use that argument for anything else. I mean, alcoholism, you know, not alcoholism. Sorry, that's horrible. Purchase of alcohol because prohibition, right? Well, we scrapped prohibition. We scrapped slavery. They even scrapped prostitution laws. So, I mean, you know, if we're a progressive society, shouldn't we progress to the point where we care about the audio health of firearm owners? But I guess we're not that progressive. I guess, can I sort of just put one final
Keep going, Daniel. No one's stopping you.
No one's stopping me. Oh, no, that's horrible. Someone should put a filter on.
That would be suppressing you.
That would be suppressing me, moderating me. Right? No, okay. So I talked about the strength of the internet. I think, and by the way, there's this one person who's absolutely fantastic. His name is Oleg Volk, and he's a top-notch photographer, but he's also a very, very big advocate of freedom. He's in the United States, and his pictures are fantastic. Like, the guy's a virtuoso in photography. But you can reach him, you know, you can message him. And he writes fantastic articles. And one of the greatest ones I've read was just by him. It was a November 28th article called Gun Buyback Scalability. And he basically said how the economics of gun buybacks just simply don't work. So the guy is multifaceted. He's fantastic. And one of the joys of the internet is you can reach out and connect with this guy. He's a very, very wonderful human being, by the way. The other thing I wanted to say was that there's a note of optimism. And the note of optimism really is that I think we're actually going to win. I think that
the notion of responsible firearm ownership and property ownership is going to win, and for one basic reason. And you can tell it's going to win because they're getting scared, right? There was, in my mind, the Coalition for Gun Control and different gun control groups, they didn't really have a succession plan. They had one or two people who were leading faces, and they didn't really have a second generation. But even more than that, we've got something which is called identity politics. And I mean, I don't want to go too much into politics, but identity politics, it basically means that listen to me because of who I am. And maybe you guys have heard the name Jordan Peterson. Maybe you've heard the name Johan Norberg. But who knows about Johan Norberg? Anyway, sorry. But they both actually said the same thing with regard to socialism. And one of the things about socialism was, do you care more about lifting up the well-being of the poor, or do you care more about hating the rich? And when I look at gun control, I really think that that's the issue, because I look at crime control and I say, do you care more about hating guns, or do you care more about ending crime or mitigating crime? And as long as you're focused on this inanimate object called the gun, then, you know, not only are you detracting scarce resources from focusing on crime and its contributing factors, but you're letting it cloud your judgment. You're really just focusing on an inanimate object, and you're not focusing on, you know, what's the background of these people. And it really becomes a double standard, right? We have a prime minister right now who's looking to rehabilitate ISIS fighters who come to Canada, and he's implicitly saying that we got to look at the people, not who carry the AK-47s, but we got to look at the mentality of them. That's his implicit argument. And yet when it comes to guns, it's, oh, guns are evil. But what about, you know, the mentality of Kim Vergil or, you know, Mark Garnier, who changed his name to Mark Garnier, right? What's his name? But not Mark Garnier, sorry, he's a liberal MP. That's horrible. I shouldn't say that at all. L'École Polytechnique, the fellow who did it. Maybe not saying the names is even better. But basically, a focus on the inanimate object is very horrible. Mark Lapine, right, is the name that they give the fellow. But when you focus on an inanimate object, right, you're not looking at core concepts, and you're also pretty much looking at after the fact. It's like you said, it's about tracing the thing after the fact. And if you want to be proactive, if you want to be progressive, you look at the contributing factors. If you don't want to be proactive, if you want to be regressive, then you say, how can we track something after the fact? And I think that focusing on the after effect actually detracts from focusing on the before the fact.
Fixated on it. That's the one problem. They're actually fixated on it, and there's nothing that we can say or do tends to change their mind on the facts. They have this hate. They fixate on it, and we can't persuade them. It doesn't matter what we say or do. It's like talking to a brick wall.
Well, I think the solution to that is really to just call it out, and eventually it's happening, right? It's like, I don't even have to say we have to do this. This is happening. It's something I've noticed. It's not even something I'm advocating. It's just something I see picking up steam. And really, this happened with the Laurier College, where they basically tried to reduce a TA to tears for even mentioning the concept of free speech. I know it's a little bit more complicated than that. I'm, you know, paraphrasing. But identity politics is really listen to me because of who I am, not because of my idea. And Milton Friedman, who's a fantastic economist and a very brave person, used to wade into college campuses and just answer random challenges. And one time someone said to him, well, you wouldn't understand what it's like to be poor. And he says, excuse me, do you know what I used to earn per day? Something like 80 cents. But he had the best zinger comeback. And it was, I think the best singers come from actual, you know, hard fought experience. And the hard-fought experience of Milton Friedman was, he said, you don't have to be poor to understand the plight of the poor, and you don't have to have cancer to be able to treat cancer. And so, you know, it's not me who's saying this, but it's coming about that people are going to say, you know what, if someone's a police chief who says, believe me because of who I am, when he talks about guns, we say, no, well, you know, how good are your arguments? We're not going to just say, believe you because you have this much experience. And I mean, really, what's a police officer's focus on guns? It's usually about how bad they are. So I don't think that police officers, too many of them, get some of my best friends are police officers. I hate to use that line, but you know, whatever. And when we talk together to some of my best friends who are police officers, they say the same thing. The top brass who land up saying that guns are bad because their experience is, you know, dealing with crime guns. But I don't know how much they actually have experience in dealing with sporting guns. I'll never forget that first day when we were scheduling my court appearance, the person who was responsible for the CFO's range inspections, I said to him, by the way, do you shoot? And he says, oh, I can't. It would be conflict of interest. But one day I'd really love to try skeet. And I felt so sad for him at that moment. I really did. It was like, you're regulating something that you want to do, but you've never done. At one point he was on the stand and I cross-examined him. I guess it's called cross-examining. I don't know. I said, have you ever shot a revolver? He says, no, I just shot my, you know, qualified with my service sidearm. And I just said that, you know, I felt sad for them because, again, it's respect me because of my position and everything. And really what it amounted to was, well, what are the quality of your arguments? And sadly, I mean, in some way, this is what's really happening when you see the CBC Post articles and people say, respect us because, you know, sadly, there was a tragedy that befell us. And we said, eventually, the tide is turning and people are saying, well, what are your arguments? Your argument can't simply be respect us because, and respect, you can respect the person. That's fine. You can't say respect my argument because of who I am. That doesn't work anymore. And as nice as I want to be, I see that other people, like, the trend is not towards that. People are actually trending to saying, well, it's nice who you are, and we respect you, and we have sympathy for you, but your arguments don't hold any water. You don't know anything about the topic. You're using prepackaged talking points. And so the demise of identity politics is actually going to be the demise of gun control. Because when you look at gun control and you look at December 6th of each year, people are coming out and say, believe our policies because of who we are, not because of the rationale of what we're arguing. And that's ending. It's ending across campuses. It had its time in the sun. And like I said, I'll respect people. I'll even respect arguments. But you know what? Larger and larger amounts of people are not respecting arguments solely based on the person who's stating them. And I think that's an optimistic tone. I think we're becoming a more enlightened culture and a more progressive culture when we actually analyze arguments as opposed to analyzing and deferring to people who said things. And this extends all the way, you know, someone can say, I served in the military, and we say, thank you for your service. What is the quality of your argument? Someone can say, I served in the police. Great. Thank you for your service. What is the quality of your argument? And someone can say, I had a tragedy. And we say, we're very sorry for your loss. What is the quality of your argument? And this isn't me advocating to say, ask that question. I'm seeing it on an increasing basis. And I'm sorry, I'm rambling here, but I think that this really is the trend of the future.
I think the points really do stand. And sadly, that's not. The people who scream the loudest do not hold that view. It's 100%. Oh well, I fill X, Y, and Z minority boxes. So believe me, because you know I've been downtrodden, not because I actually know what I'm talking about or I have any actual topic knowledge to share. And sadly, that's where we're things were headed. And hopefully, like you said, hopefully things aren't going that way anymore.
Well, I can see the trends already beginning to change. And, you know, there's a great, I think it's a military aphorism that basically says you can only raise that flag so high on the pole until it breaks or something. And it's the pendulum, really. You can only swing the pendulum so far in one direction until it starts to come back. And you got to be careful, because when the pendulum swings back, it really doesn't care about anybody's feelings. And I think you're starting to see groups, you know, like you can call them trolls or whatever you call them, but I think they're just the leading edge of that pendulum swinging back. And they're basically saying, you know, you want to claim that because of who you are, we should listen to what you're saying, but we don't buy that. And I think anybody, a basic student, who's told that, you know, trust me because of my position of authority. Well, you know, that's one of the worst things you can say to somebody, because then they'll say, well, wait a minute, what's the quality of your argument? And, yeah, I don't know. I really think that's the trend that's moving forward. And I think it's going to happen all by itself. I think, we're at a stage in Canadian history where, I've never seen a finance minister be treated the way that the current finance minister is. I've never seen a prime minister be treated the way the current prime minister is. And it's one of those things where people say, we respect the office in theory. We respect that, you know, you got elected and the votes of the people in theory. We respect all that. But you know what? The stuff that's coming out of your mouth, the actual arguments you're making, we're not really buying. And, when you take a look at a poll and it says, do you like this person? Which leader is the most likable? I mean, right there, that question tells you everything. If your whole thing is who's most likable, you're focusing on the person rather than the argument. And the fact that so many political surveys still use that question is spooky.
Yeah, it's like a smoke and mirror tactic. They're taking away from, as you said, what is the quality of your argument? Well, am I shiny, pointy, or am I am I qualified to do what I do?
It's Fahrenheit 451 all over again.
Sorry. No. You guys, sorry?
It's Fahrenheit 451 all over again. That scene where the guys, where they're looking at the candidates and, well, that guy's got nice, that guy looks nice, and but you're not listening to what he's saying. Yeah, but he looks nice. How could he be wrong? I just feel like he has nice hair. Yeah. How could he be wrong?
And this is where you get Martin Luther King's famous saying, right? He says he wants people to be judged based on the content of their character, not the color of their skin. And identity politics is all about judging people based on, you know, who they are versus the content of what they're arguing or stating. So, I mean, look, it started in the 60s. I'm sure it started before then, but it's just picking up speed. It's picking up speed fast. And I think, you know how it goes, it's always darkest before the dawn or something? Is that a Florence and the Machine reference? Okay. So they say that, you know, identity politics is going to be the most strong right before it starts to wither and fall apart. And, you know, I really, really think that we should always take into account people's feelings. But we should never, ever let a focus on people's feelings detract from frank and honest and sincere analysis of arguments. And I mean, it's a disservice, right? It's basically dishonest to say, we're not going to evaluate the strength of your argument because of who you are. That's horrible. That's, you know, reverse genderism, reverse racism, reverse whatever. It's a double standard. And it's horrible to say, you know what? We're giving you a pass on logic because of who you are. That's a disservice to everybody. That's disrespect. And if you say we're giving you a pass because of a tragedy, then you're disrespecting the tragedy as well.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
well
sorry.
Said. Well said, Dan.
Probably the less said for the better, but yeah.
Okay, thank you so much, Daniel. Do you want to stick around for the events and listener feedback? You're more than welcome to.
Sure. Why not? I'll try to keep my interjections to a minimum.
Feel free to jump in.
Okay.
Event number one, 2018 Gunny Girl Calendar. The SFRC Gunny Girl Calendar, Gunny Girls Invade the SFRC. It's going to happen on Saturday, December 9th at 12 to about 3 at the SFRC, 4567 Road 38, South Frontenac Township, Ontario. Links in the show notes. Kelly, join Kelly Lynn, Tracy, your favorite calendar girls, and Team CCFR at the SFRC AmmoSource on Saturday, December 9th, 12 to 3 for a calendar signing and sale event. Come on down and get your calendar in person. Save the tax and on shipping and have the girls sign their month. And get 10% off your store purchase at SFRC. The girls will have their have stickers and lanyards to hand out, and you can get your CFR membership at the same time. Don't miss this special chance to support women in the shooting sports and get your Christmas shopping started. Links in the show notes.
And I'll actually be there because I forgot to renew my CCFR membership. So I promised Tracy I'd be there next Saturday. Next one is...
You're driving all the way to Frontenac, Thomas?
Well, I get 10% off, too. It's not that far. It's, what, a 90-minute drive?
SFRC? Plus, I get to
hang out with Tracy. Yeah.
That's like... that's for sure at least 3 hours.
Okay, maybe I'll mail it in to them. Next one. I didn't realize this, but East Hill Outdoors, which is 35115 just north of 401, they have a ladies' archery night every Thursday. It's $10. It's from 6:30 to 9 p.m. Ladies can go in there. You get a lane, bow, rental, and instructions all for $10. So if you have any lady friends that want to try archery, just drop by East Hill Outdoors every Thursday night between 6:30 and 9. And for $10, you can get learn to shoot a bow. They also have, right now, it's ongoing. It's a 2017 Whitetail Classic, and it's not too late to sign up. You just go in there. For $20, you get a t-shirt, you get a fast-track entry into the contest. They're giving away a Polaris four-wheeler and a random draw this year. And I think it said 25. I think it's actually 35,000. It's a really big giveaway. Guns, four-wheelers, all kinds of stuff. I put the link in the show notes, or you can actually go into East Hill Outdoors, just go in the front and say you want to enter the contest. They'll sign you up, give you a t-shirt for $20. Listener email, Benny?
Listener email. I was just going to say I've already spent my $20 on random draws this year, so I will not be entering that one, although it sounds great. So, listener feedback. Hi, folks. Just a note to say that I enjoy your effort on the podcast. Well, thank you. I try so hard. It's on the list along with Slamfire Radio and Modern Rifleman Radio. The Canadian content, news, and perspective is important to this listener. I like the ear protection episode. It seems like the 556 blank search has ended, but I just found that Dr. Deals in Moncton has some in stock if you're still looking. Thanks for your hours of entertainment, New Brunswick Hillbilly. Well, thank you, New Brunswick Hillbilly. Please thank send back, send any feedback, questions, or comments you may have to host@newshootercanada.ca or our Facebook page or in the comment section of our website at newshootercanada.ca. iTunes, Stitcher, nothing?
Facebook, we're at 1,271 when I looked this afternoon.
Well, I'm not in a position to argue with that one yet. So, yeah, no, 1,271 still. Closing comments? I guess.
I got one.
Oh, go for it.
I don't know if you've described the I don't get any benefit from this, but the Maccabi Defense SLR.
Yes.
Have you talked over this one already?
Yeah, we talked about it. It came up last year, last episode.
That looks exciting to me. I mean, what a better Hanukkah gift than something called Maccabi, right?
really, you're right. I don't have that disposal cash you seem to speak of, but I can get you in touch with some really nice made Canadian furniture and barrels if you're interested. Ontario sourced, actually.
Once Daniel starts a family, he might not have that disposable cash. So.
That's why he needs to get it now.
Once the little ones start coming, there goes that money. You're gonna start saving for school and everything else.
That is probably the one biggest reason to ever buy that a husband will ever tell his wife why he should buy something is I won't be able to do it later and I got to get grandfathered in.
It's weird how the generational thing goes because you're about to have a kid, you have to get grandfathered. I don't know. That's there's some time warp involved in that. Right?
Exactly.
And we know why Thomas doesn't have children and he has a safe full of guns.
So, Christmas and Hanukkah is coming, so send in your Christmas wish lists and your Hanukkah wish lists. It's up to you guys. And we'll read them on our Christmas episode. Shout outs. Thomas?
First of all, a shout out to Joan from Silverdale. Thank you very much for inviting me to the event. I had a lot of fun. Kelly Guns, I actually have Kelly Guns online. I got the hats and shotgun arrived extremely quickly. And you get free shipping for any orders on $250, which is great because a lot of places nowadays are not giving you free shipping unless it's $300 or $400. So it was really nice. Also, Matthew from the Geeks Gadgets and Gun, he wrote in the Surefire. He mentioned he's got three or four different Surefires that he mentioned. So, and we actually had, we were talking about Turkish guns earlier. We had a gentleman named Mustafa from Turkey contact the show. And he actually has a shotgun company in Turkey. And he's trying to set us up as his distributor to sell shotguns in Canada. He was kind of disappointed that we were just a podcast and that we don't sell guns. But we appreciate Mustafa contacting the show and trying to get us to sell us shotguns.
Yeah, and you know, whatever. In a couple months, maybe in a couple years, maybe we'll get back in touch with him when New Shooter Canada has a storefront and a very strong internet presence.
And when Benny has some working capital.
And I have some working capital. Mike's not here this week, so I guess that leaves it up to me. Shout out to, again to my lovely wife, although, yeah, I got kicked out of the house tonight for because I'm too loud during podcast. So the little one can sleep. So, but she lets me. She let me leave. So that's a positive.
Are you in the car?
No, I went to the to a different compound for recording tonight.
Well, you should have said you went to Tim Hortons. It couldn't have gotten more quintessentially Canadian than that.
You know,
I'm at Tim H.
The only time I ever claimed to be Canadian was when people accused me of being American. That's about it.
So Benny, where are you right now?
I don't know. Where am I?
Undisclosed location X.
Exactly.
You're in the secret igloo of Georgia's?
Oh well, if there was a little more snow on the ground, it would be an igloo. Right now, it's just, you know, a hole in the ground.
Okay, I'm not gonna go there.
It's a little cold. So shout out to my wife as usual, and I guess shout out to my parents for letting me do the podcast from their living room. So yeah, that's where I am this week.
And nice, Dan.
Yeah, I got a shout out to my dad for schlepping the safe for me. Gun cabinet or so whatever it's called these days. I don't know what you're supposed to call them. Yeah. And Danny, for coming on the show tonight. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you for allowing me to rant and ramble. But,
well, I've actually wanted to get you as a guest on the show for a long time, and I won't call him Danny. I've always referred to him as Daniel.
Oh, it's all good. I guess a shout out to a bunch of people who are dead, but you know, hopefully they appreciate it. Herbert, so there are three of my favorite books. With regard to World War One, World War Two, Herbert McBride's A Rifleman Went to War, and that's quoted by everybody. I mean, this guy was an American who joined up with the Canadian forces because he thought the U.S. was taking too long to get to war. So he was a very interesting, very knowledgeable guy. One of those guys who got promoted and then busted down and promoted and busted down, but he's just, you know, great. And then two books that actually cite him. One was John B. George's, and if you're going to get the book, get the extended version that has his time in Burma with the donkey supply trains with Ord Wingate's group. So the book's called Shots Fired in Anger, and it references A Rifleman Went to War, but Shots Fired in Anger is basically warfare in Guadalcanal and in the Pacific. And the other one is With British Snipers to the Reich, which is by Captain Clifford Shore. And he also cites, you know, A Rifleman Went to War. But those are, you know, and it's two different theaters of combat, which is always interesting, right? The European theater versus the Pacific.
Sorry, but, what was the last title again?
With British Snipers to the Reich. And, I mean, Shots Fired in Anger, I think, what was his name? Oh, dear me. He's a fantastic shooter. I'm trying to remember his name, but he, Jerry Michaluk. So he actually referenced Shots Fired in Anger because of the topic when it discusses the M1 carbine. But what happens is, so John B. George had a fantastic amount of firsthand experience, and inside that book there's every single detail of Japanese firearms you could ever want. It's a fantastic written book. With British Snipers to the Reich, there's a lot more anecdotal stuff, things heard, you know, secondhand or whatever, but it gives a lot of thought. One of the great things is if you read this, it's about a British person who basically foresees gun control coming to Britain. So, I mean, he's very prescient. But these are some fantastic things. And Jeff Cooper wrote an introduction to A Rifleman Went to War. So shout out to those guys. And, of course, shout out to my lovely wife, Shauna. And, yeah, shout out to you guys. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you always got to include the better half.
Definitely the better half in my case. I mean,
okay. Take us away, Thomas.
Until next week, keep your barrels downrange and smoking. Take a kid shooting.
It's not about the odds. It's about the stakes. Danny, do you have a goodbye line?
Stay on target. Definitely stay on target, and really, really don't let the stuff off in the periphery distract you.
Well said.
Well said. Good night, folks.
Take care.
I really like 22 Mag.
Thanks for listening. We'd love to hear from you with any questions or feedback you may have, or if you just want to call shenanigans. You can contact us at host@newshootercanada.ca or through our Facebook page.
The way they look, I like the shiny steel and the polished wood. I don't care if they're big or small. They're for sale, hell, I want them all. I like guns, I like guns, I like guns.